Ho, ho, ho.
Hello, hello, good morning. Yes, it is Monday. Yes, it is December Dickens. And yes, we are about to talk about the French Revolution. Hello, and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. For this week's novel, A Tale of Two Cities, I read the Barnes & Noble Classics version with an introduction by Gillian D'Arcy Wood, which I would highly, highly recommend. In fact, I'm prefacing this episode with a brief discussion of it because I think that it added so much to my approach of the novel and my actual experience as well. In this introduction, Gillian talks about Dickens' character and person at length and centers on first, the two cities, which are England and France, and second, on Dickens' obsession with mob mentality. He actually would go to executions to gauge the mob itself, not for the actual execution, and wrote at length about it in The Times, the London Times, as well as in his other books. A comment from Gillian that I thought was particularly insightful was his mention that Dickens often uses children to facilitate the horrors of the world, and that obviously rang true for me, especially because we just finished Oliver Twist together last week. Another thought on the introduction. It reminded me quite a bit of the threshold model, not to be confused with threshold theory, which has to do with bilingualism, but the model essentially gives a number to every person involved in a mob and says that any given individual's threshold is the amount of people who have to participate before they themselves start participating. So a person with a threshold of zero in a mob is the first person to throw a rock and hit a window. I believe actually that Malcolm Gladwell talks about this theory, though I'm not sure in which body of work it was, or whether it was in a book or podcast or both. I've just gone ahead and linked a brilliant paper on the threshold model directly in the description in case anyone is interested. Now on to the bulk of the novel, where we're going to discuss the history behind and in A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. The novel begins in 1775, which is to say that it begins in the midst of a period of intense unrest for both England and France. This period is likely familiar to you, especially if you're an American, because the book starts in the middle of the Revolutionary War, where France joined the colonies in a fight against England to win the eventual independence of the New Englanders. Now, if you haven't had a crash course in European history lately, you might be wondering, why would France help the colonies against Britain? Isn't Europe just Europe? Well, actually, from 1756 to 1763, there was a conflict called the Seven Years' War. I mean, it has many names, like sometimes it's called the French and Indian War because of the leg fought in North America, but anywho, it was the first big global conflict, so the fighting took place on three major continents, and if I were to simplify it was a war between Britain and France over long-standing conflicts, mostly about Britain's newly acquired territory in North America. Britain won big time, of course, sending France into debt, disrepair, and shame for quite a while. So the book meets the reader for the first time with a character named Jerry Cruncher in the midst of all of this, who works for the infamous Tellison's Bank, among other things. He sends a message to Jarvis Lorry, who then picks it up and waits for a young woman named Lucy Manette. It seems that in the midst of the social unrest of France, that her father, once a great physician, has finally been found, though his time spent in prison has shocked him into becoming a devoted shoemaker. Along the way, a character named Defarge is introduced, and we'll learn as the book progresses in little hints that he's a revolutionary in France with a moral compass and a very cruel wife. To get back to the plot at hand, though, Lucy finds her father and shocks him back into his previous state. 5 years pass. It's 1780, and we enter the scene with Charles Darnay, a French pseudo-nobleman who is getting tried for spying for France against England, where he's been residing indefinitely. There is a big court scene with a few minor characters, and Lucy and her father also show up to hear the verdict. He is acquitted, by the way. Historically, though tensions between France and England were still on the rise, a sort of random light in the midst of all of this appeared as the Edict of Toleration, where England under Joseph II for the first time recognized the rights of non-Catholics, which is a big move, especially for Habsburg ruler. The Habsburgs, by the way, were the oldest and most pure English monarchs, though the bloodline became incestuous eventually, causing them to be known for their rather large chins and weak hearts. Back in France, we are exposed to the cruel despotism of a marquis as he parades through the streets, eventually hitting with his carriage and killing a poor child that was running in the streets. Again, Dickens usually tries to show pain through children, so this child is mercilessly killed and needlessly killed in the streets. As an aside, one of my favorite descriptions from the novel actually is of his house when Dickens describes it, and I'm paraphrasing, as a sort of curious and mismatched place, not happily lived in despite its tastefulness and expense. I just think that juxtaposition between expensive and uncomfortable is really interesting, especially since you think of monarchs eating chocolate and being really comfortable all the time, but in fact, this marquis is quite unhappy in his own home. The Marquis, back at home, is waiting for his nephew, and you guessed it, that's Darnay, to arrive for dinner. When he does, however, all they do is argue about the place and efficacy of the French aristocracy, and later that night, the Marquis is mysteriously murdered with only Jacques written beside the body. Jacques was actually the name that French revolutionaries went by in the build-up before the true French Revolution, or at least before the first true French Revolution, which was in 1789. After another year, Darnay asks for Lucy's hand in marriage, and though she has several suitors, she decides to marry him. At the same time, news of the many spies in France runs amok, and many of them flock to Defarge's wine shop, where his wife, Madame Defarge, one of my favorite characters because of her resemblance to Lady Macbeth, sits knitting a list of the people she thinks should be ousted by the revolutionaries. Then it's time for Darnay and Lucy to get married. Darnay tells Mr. Manette that he is basically a nobleman, which to Manette is shocking, and he responds by freaking out and relapsing into making more shoes. Fear not, though, because he finds himself eventually, and Lucy is able to reconcile with her other suitors in the meanwhile. The most exciting part of the book is when the year changes to 1789. So, 1789. In France, the government back then was separated into estates. The first estate was the monarchy and aristocracy. The second estate was the white-collar workers, like doctors and state officials. Probably some of the aristocracy was in here as well. And the third estate was everyone else, which is about 60% or more of the population at that time. The first estate obviously got the most say into how the laws were made, which became quite problematic as the tensions increased in the peasantry, and during a meeting on June 17th of that year, the third estate swarmed the building and declared themselves the, quote, National Assembly of France, furthermore declaring that they would have an equal vote in the assembly from that point forward. We don't have time to get into the nitty-gritty of what all happens next, but it's a ton, okay? A few days later, the tennis court oath occurs and sparks the French Revolution. The people also storm the Bastille and destroy it literally brick by brick. And fun fact, that's where France's Independence Day, Bastille Day, comes from. But anyway, the Great Fear spreads, which played out kind of like the Red Scare of the 1950s in America, but with peasants instead of communists. It takes a while, but after the declaration about the rights of man that is absolutely ignored, there is a women's march on Versailles, and they go after Marie Antoinette, and then after that, some real fighting occurs, though of course all the events I just mentioned are still technically included in the actual French Revolution as well. To make things worse, the Haitian Revolution happens at the same time as this, and what essentially happens there is that a slave called Toussaint L'Ouverture leads a coup and overthrows the French puppet government, creating a free Haiti and adding even more fear to France's dinner plate at the time. These events are depicted in the novel by a literal storming of the Bastille and then a plea from one of the aristocratic servants for Darnay to come save them from prison. Unfortunately, however, when Darnay sets foot in Paris, he gets arrested, and the first time it is for general crimes, and then again after he is reported by Defarge and his wife. Great fear, what did I tell you? The next part gets into some serious spoilers, so continue at your own risk. At Darnay's trial, a letter from Dr. Manette is introduced saying that the reason for Manette's imprisonment and pseudo-craziness is because Darnay's father and uncle raped a woman and stabbed her brother, and then Manette was called to tend to them, but Manette got arrested so that he wouldn't tell the authorities about why he was there to treat the two patients. With this piece of evidence, Defarge is sentenced to death on behalf of his crazy ancestors, and he is about to die on one of France's famous scaffolds. That night at the wine shop, Madame Defarge schemes that she wants to have Lucy, as well as Lucy and Darnay's daughter, executed, and her vendetta is revealed when we find out that she's the surviving sibling of the people that Darnay's ancestors mistreated so long ago. So while this is going on in the personal lives of the characters, more unrest is going on socially and politically in France. There was a flight of the monarchy, which ended in Louis XVI's execution, and many, many more attacks and events that ended with France, at least for a moment, being able to rest in a government that had a semblance of fluid democracy or somewhat more equality than they had before. One of Lucy's suitors, to finish the novel, actually substitutes his life for Danae's, ultimately sacrificing his head for who he said was the greater man, though he actually salvages his moral integrity in the end of the novel because of this. Madame Defarge is ousted with her own gun and does not obviously succeed in killing any of the people who indirectly mistreated her and her family. And let me tell you, this is probably the weirdest happily ever after that I think I have ever read, period. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, consider checking out the last episode where I discuss how to read a book a week. Everything DH and I can be found at didianandhawthorne.blueberry.net, except blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @didianin. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course new projects and episodes relating to DH and I, including something that may or may not be happening in February. I'm very, very excited to be able to tell you guys that in January, but you can find it on Twitter right now. Also, stay tuned for the next episode on Saturday. We will be diving into Dickens' short stories and how short story collections are made and published. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. I will see you guys on Saturday.